Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Roger Flynn. He's the founding director and managing attorney of the Western Mining Action Project, a nonprofit law firm representing the public interest on hard rock mining issues in the West since 1993. Roger's also an adjunct professor at the University of Colorado School of Law, where he's been teaching courses in mining and natural resources law since 2002. Well, first, thank you, Roger, for being on the show, and thank you also for your work.
Oh, you're very welcome. Glad to be here.
Okay, so can you give people an introduction to mining on public lands? I mean, when people think about public lands, they think about just sort of walking in some beautiful forest. Or before we turned on the recorder, you and I were talking about how absolutely beautiful it is in the state and national parks here in the Redwoods. And that's, I think, what people think about when they think about public lands is some beautiful place or the Grand Canyon or something. But can you tell me about mining in on these lands?
Sure, I'd be happy to. About a half of the western states are public lands. That's owned by you and I in trust for the American public, and which is about a third of the entire landmass of the country. And we're not even talking about Alaska issues, which is sort of a separate legal structure up there with millions of acres of public land as well. And under the old 1872 mining law, which was a law passed by Congress and signed by President Grant, the mining has been viewed in the West as what the industry will say is the highest and best use, that mining takes precedence over all other uses. Now, not all of the lands in the West, the public lands, are open for hard rock mining. Wilderness areas, national parks, national monuments, lands that have been protected by Congress or the President, for example, are not open under the 1872 mining law. But the vast majority of public lands in the West are open for any citizen, including a corporate citizen or a shell company from a foreign company from Canada, for example, can go onto the public lands this afternoon and stake put four stakes in the ground, sometimes a fifth stake, and you've established a mining claim against the United States public. And that process was started actually informally by the miners themselves in the gold rush of California, 1848-49, and Colorado about 10 years later. And it was made into law by Congress in 1872 formally. So ever since then, anyone can go out there and stake claims, and you have a right then to go out and explore for minerals, the phrase in the old law. And this law has not changed in its core principles. Since 1872, it says lands belonging to the United States are, quote, free and open to exploration and purchase, end quote. So what that meant was it was sort of the granddaddy of the laissez-faire manifest destiny laws that were in place, and was the predominant goal and policy of the country was to get people, get industry out west, get it settled, get the minerals developed. To heck with the Native American tribes, as you can imagine, they bore the brunt of this certainly initial rush in the post-Civil War era for the first two generations. And those laws have largely been all repealed. There's no longer free and open for oil and gas, for example. Oil and gas was taken out of the mining law in 1920. For example, if someone wants to have an oil to develop oil and gas on our public lands, they have to get a lease, just like you would for your apartment, from the Interior Department or the Interior Department's agency, the BLM, or the Bureau of Land Management. So it's entirely at the discretion of the BLM as to which lands get leased. So a conservation-minded person in charge of BLM would likely lease less oil and gas lands. More industry-friendly, maybe, would lease more. But it's still up to the federal government, and they're subject to public pressure. They're subject to oversight by people's comments and things like that. But that's not the case for the 1872 mining law. The BLM or the Forest Service for Forest Service lands cannot say no to someone going out and claiming unless the land is taken away from claiming by the President or Congress, or in some small areas, the Secretary of Interior, which rarely happens. So mining has been viewed, if you really go back to the Middle Ages, as what our economy, our industry, our military might depends on minerals was the predominant view, and that's enshrined in our Western public lands. Other laws were all repealed back then, the unlimited logging, unlimited grazing, unlimited other developments on public land. But the mining is what Charles Wilkinson, maybe the leading natural resources law professor in the West, has called the last of the lords of yesterday that still govern our public lands. And what the Western Mining Action Project does is we help communities, Native American tribes, conservation groups, try to have their voices heard in stopping or at least trying to make mines that go in more environmentally friendly. But it's the predominant view in the West is under the law that mining comes first, and it trumps hunting and fishing, it trumps recreation, it trumps all other competing uses of public land. So you can imagine when a tribe or a community is faced with one of these behemoth mines or slew of small-scale mines going in all over the West, it's a tough road to get our voices heard in this battle over protecting public lands from industrial mining.
Okay, so just to be clear, I mean, you said this, but it's kind of shocking in a sense that so I decide I'm going to go mine. I can go out to pretty much, I mean, for now, let's just say we'll worry about the caveats maybe later. But basically, I can go anywhere I want on BLM land, and I can put up those stakes, and then I have a mine. It's not that
easy. There's steps. You have the free right to go out and file your claims. Then you have to file it with the BLM and their local county property recorder. Costs you the current fee, as I haven't tracked it recently, it's a little over $100. You have to pay BLM to file your claim, but they can't say no. They can't say, well, we don't want you to file your claim there. That's up to Congress or the President particularly. If the area is not closed off, there's nothing the federal government can do to stop you from filing your claims. That doesn't mean you have a mine. That means you have a claim upon the federal minerals. And then what you'll have to do, depending on how big the mine that you want to put in, usually you'd want to explore first to see how much minerals are there, because it's obviously an economic consideration. All land has minerals technically, but how much land is where the actual valuable minerals are is obviously a question for geology and economics and things like that. So you file your claim. You can sit on those if you pay your $100+ a year forever. There's no requirement for you to actually propose mining on those lands. And some mining companies, especially the big multinationals, will hold thousands and thousands of claims around the West, and maybe they'll propose developing one set of 1,000 claims over here or 1,000 claims over there at a time. Some have multiple operations, either proposed or ongoing. Each claim is about 20 acres in size. So if you're a multinational company, in my experience, some of these big mines will propose mines and our operating mines on our public lands covering 6, 8, 10,000 acres at a pop. These mines are some of the most destructive things mankind can do to the environment and to the earth. It's pretty, if you've ever seen pictures of some of these, they are, or visited them, they're quite staggering. So filing the claim doesn't get you the mine approved. That would have to go through a process from the BLM or the Forest Service, depending on which lands they're managed by. And the problem, because of the 1872 mining law, with very, very, very few exceptions, the BLM or the Forest Service has never said no to a mining proposal on public land. We had the Clinton administration, one of the last days of their second term, deny a mine proposal to protect Native American sacred land in southeastern California, and that was quickly overturned. That denial was quickly overturned by the Bush administration, which, as you can imagine, was more mining-friendly than the Clinton administration. So it's a process of filing claims. Then if you decide to explore then you submit an exploration plan to the federal government, and that they'll do their environmental reviews. But in almost the vast majority of cases, the BLM or the Forest Service will say yes to the exploration. And then if the company finds valuable minerals, they will go and submit the plan for the full-scale mine, which can cover anywhere from a small mine of a few acres to 15,000 acres at a time on our public lands. And maybe the kicker to your audience is whatever minerals that the mining company, and a lot of these mining companies are foreign-based, South Africa, particularly Canada, have mining operations in the United States. Some of the world's biggest mining companies are Canadian companies operating in the United States. They will literally will pull billions of dollars, and have pulled, and have proposals to pull many more billions of dollars of gold and copper off of our public lands, and they pay zero royalty. Yeah, that's right, zero royalty. That was the policy back in 1872. And that's still the policy and the law today. In contrast, if, as I was saying earlier, an oil and gas company, Exxon, Chevron, whoever, goes on our public lands and gets a lease from BLM to explore and then develop oil and gas resources, as you know, there's a boom going on right now in that due to hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Whatever minerals, whatever oil and gas the big oil companies pull out of the ground on public lands, they pay a gross royalty of 12.5%. So that adds up to some serious money. So on a $100 million oil and gas operation, the American taxpayers, you know, get $12.5 million right off the top. The mining companies pay zero. Now, they'll pay some state taxes, and of course their workers pay taxes and things like that. But one of the real sticking points over the years has been the fact that these gigantic multinationals who pull billions from our minerals, our public minerals, pay zero royalty. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty good sweetheart deal, which they have fought forever successfully to block any change in that in Congress. And due to the power of the Western hard rock mining industry, particularly the gold and the copper companies and their congressional allies, the 1872 mining law has been on the books since 1872 with no change. Some minerals like oil and gas have been pulled out, and some lands have been closed off to mining, like national parks, for example, you mentioned. But the vast majority of public land in the West is open under that as the best deal you can get if you're a multinational extraction company. You want to be a mining company under that deal more than any other company.
So I lived for a couple of years in northeastern Nevada, and there were gold mines all over the place, and they were, many of them, like you say, were owned by Canadian companies. And it's just extraordinary to me that they're doing this incredible damage, and I mean, A, that they're doing incredible damage, that's bad enough, but in addition, then not paying a dime for the royalties. Can you talk about some of the environmental problems associated with let's focus for a moment on some of the large mines. What do they do to somebody who may live in Georgia or New York City or Los Angeles? You know, they may never have visited any of the mines. What are some of the environmental effects of routine environmental effects of especially the large mines for a moment?
Right. You had mentioned northeastern Nevada, especially an area known as the Carlin Trend and some of the other areas.
Oh, I lived in Carlin.
Yeah, there you go. It's one of the world's largest gold-producing regions, and it still is. There are mines up and down the Carlin Trend. There are other mines in nearby mineral belts. Oftentimes, minerals are found where there are mountain ranges or old volcanoes, for example. As you can imagine, the gold or the copper is brought up through these earth forces, so to speak. I would say as far as these big mining operations, most today are open pit mines because the grade or the percentage of the valuable mineral you want, gold or copper, is so low, we're talking in the decimals of ounces per ton. You have to have the gigantic economies of scale. So you'll have mines that will be 8,000 acres, where the mining pit itself would be maybe half mile or a mile wide and many thousands of feet, 2,000-3,000 feet deep. Now that's just the pit itself. Most of the rock, or a good percentage of the rock that you want to, where you think the gold is, a lot of it does not contain any valuable gold. For example, we call that waste rock. They have to blast through that in gigantic 40-foot step levels, if you can think of stepping down, or a circular vortex going down towards the center of the pit, 40, 50 feet high at a time. And they just dump that on the side of the mountain, or, you know, of the valley, wherever they are. And some of these waste rock piles themselves are 400 or 500 feet tall, covering hundreds or thousands of acres at a time. And then you have the chemical processing that goes on with these low-grade ore deposits, and these are the bulk of the big mines in the West, and in other areas of the world too, is you'll have, for example, the way to extract gold out of low-grade ore is through leaching with cyanide. So they take they get rid of the waste rock, which may take a year or two. They dump it on the side. No, not many environmental controls at all. And then they'll get to the ore that actually contains what their geologists say has the gold. They'll oftentimes crush that to a fine pebble-like, or even smaller consistency, maybe larger, depending on what the geologists say. And they will dump them on plastic liners in big heaps, sometimes many hundreds of feet tall, covering a mile or more long. And then they will douse that heap. It used to be with sort of your conventional garden sprinklers, but now it's more of a drip irrigation system, if you can imagine. They lay these hoses almost like a football field every few yards, crisscrossing the heap after they've dumped this ore on it, and they will soak that heap, or leach it, with a dilute cyanide solution. Yes, that's cyanide, one of the most nasty chemicals you can think of, very toxic, and that will, through gravity, drain through. And the chemists found out years ago that, you know, over 100 years ago, that cyanide chemically reacts with gold. So the cyanide mixes with the gold, leaches to the bottom. Hopefully you don't have a tear in your liner, which has happened in many occasions, as you can imagine, as the companies rush to get production going. And they will collect that toxic soup of gold and cyanide and other metals that get leached out and pump it up to a processing plant where they will then try to chemically de-extract, if that's a word, the cyanide from the gold. Gold then goes to another processing series of steps to get that gold bar at the end, which is what the company is looking for. And then hopefully the cyanide gets reused. Well, it would get reused, and hopefully they haven't, none of it's gone out. And actually, reputable mining companies will want that cyanide to get out, for example, when it leaches to the bottom, because that is mixed with the gold. So they certainly don't want that to happen. So on the big mining operations today, I'd say the first impact, if you were visiting from somewhere else and you weren't familiar with this, is just the sheer scale, you know, thousands of feet deep mine pit, half mile across, some of these even bigger, and then these gigantic waste piles and chemical leach facilities. I described the gold and cyanide leaching for copper, which is also the scene of these gigantic mines. They use sulfuric acid to leach the copper out, and if you know, they learned that years ago as well. But the same process goes on with dealing with copper mine proposals in the West. People are obviously concerned about just the sheer scale and the destruction of our wildlife habitat, recreation lands, for example. And then there's the issue, if you had to pick a second one outside of the sheer scale of the destruction, is water. Obviously, if any of that chemical gets out, whether sulfuric acid or cyanide, you're going to do a number on ground and surface water. Many mines in the West, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, have had serious environmental problems with these chemicals getting out. But even if the chemicals themselves that they use to leach the minerals don't get out, so to speak, or be released uncontrolled into the environment, you have oftentimes at mines, particularly depending on the geology, what's known as acid mine drainage, which minerals, like gold and copper, are often found like I was saying earlier, with old volcanoes and things like that. So it's very high in sulfur. And locked in the mountain, there's no problem. The water is fine. There's no water that seeps out in springs. It's probably very pure water. Problem is when you blast open a mountain, or in the old days, there's still a couple of these underground mines, you expose the rock which contains the sulfur with oxygen and water when it rains and snows. And so that combination, from, if you remember from high school chemistry, creates a sulfuric acid, very, very acidic solution, which leaches, which is nasty in itself, but it leaches out other metals. Arsenic, cadmium, lead, zinc, these are not something you want to drink, and certainly something you do not want, which is even worse for aquatic life, fish, and wildlife, for example. So this toxic stew of acid mine drainage, there are mines that are 20-plus years old in the West that are still leaking out acid mine drainage that are requiring taxpayer cleanup, because a lot of the mining companies have gone bankrupt and long since disappeared, and you and I are faced with that bill as taxpayers for cleanup, and that's obviously a problem there. And so water is often the issue, water pollution, and in some of these big mines, is if you remember some of those big behemoths in Nevada, the mine pits get so deep that they have to pump the water out, because the valuable ore where the gold or the copper is below the current water table, the water table that existed before the mine went in, and they have to pump that out. And some of these mines, in these big mines, will have to pump that out 20, 30,000 gallons a minute round the clock for 20, 30, 40 years. You can imagine how much water that is. And what that does when you essentially pull the plug via a pumping operation of the entire ecosystem support system, all the rivers, the streams, the springs, all go dry. We have a case in Nevada federal court right now arguing that the BLM really shouldn't be able to allow that, for mines to do that, because it does such a number on streams and springs and the wildlife and the people that rely on that, whether from a spiritual and religious side for Native Americans, or from an economic side for water supply for our Western communities, or recreation for trout fishing and hunting and fishing and wildlife. I mean, if you either poison or remove the water in a mountain range or a valley, you can imagine what that does to the ecosystem. It essentially drains it of its lifeblood.
And I'm also thinking, I don't know if you know this, but I grew up in Colorado, and Boulder, actually. And
just down the road, I'm in the small little town of Lyons, about a half an hour north of Boulder.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, I grew up in Louisville, which is, you know, close enough. Anyway, I spent a lot of time in the mountains of Colorado, and one of my main memories from being a child and being back in those hills is A, how long it took for the roads to the roads haven't disappeared, and B, walking over tailings piles that are from the 1870s and still are essentially devoid of life.
Right. Well, that's that acid mine drainage I was saying. Even just the casual tourist going up to the ski resorts in Summit County or Vail or along I-70, you'll see these sort of yellow piles of rock. And if you look closely, those are at the mouth of old mine tunnels. And some of them, depending on the geology, the pollution, the acid mine drainage is not an issue. Maybe there wasn't a lot of sulfur. It was buffered or diluted by other water or rock. But oftentimes, that's not the case. There are literally thousands, if not some reports, hundreds of thousands of stream miles in the West that are still polluted by acid mine drainage from these old mines that are leaking and leaking. Because once the water table interacts, these oftentimes in the old days, underground mines, when the ore grade, when the grade of the mineral you want was very high percentage, you could almost see the vein of gold in mixed into the rock. Now it's all this microscopic, big open pit operations, or most mines. But some of these, many of these old tunnels are still leaking, and a good chunk of Western water supplies are contaminated by mines from 100 plus years ago.
So I'm sure that you know the history of mining infinitely better than I. Even though, by the way, I went to the Carroll School of Mines, just want to mention that.
Oh, a great school. I mean, the mining industry's best geologists and economists and geophysicists, School of Mines, great school for that field of work.
Yeah. So knowing, I'm presuming you really know the history of mining. I'm wondering, what is the oldest mine that we, what I'm asking is, oldest mines that we know of, are even they recovered? Like if you go back 2,000 years old to some of the mines in ancient Greece, have they recovered? And I know they're much smaller in scale. And so that's the first question. The second question is, then it sounds, everything you're saying, it sounds like this is not recoverable. Even on a medium-term geologic scale. I mean,
Right. There are, and again, I haven't visited these, but just anecdotally stories about mines that the Romans developed back, 2,000 years ago, that are still leaking acid mine drainage. And obviously, the mines in the American West are a lot younger. There are some mines, for example, our biggest mine in many ways is the Bingham Canyon mine west of Salt Lake. And that started out as a relatively small mine back the turn of the last century, but now it is one of the largest mines in the world. And it's just, if you've been out to the Bingham Canyon site, the size of it is staggering. And the groundwater plume that is coming out from the mine is contaminated, and they're trying to clean it up and remediate that. But once the pollution starts, particularly once you get it in groundwater and surface water, it's really tough to clean up. I mean, money helps. There are ways to pump and treat, so to speak, but obviously the companies don't want to do that. That's an incredible financial burden. So one of the problems, and studies have shown that mining operations paint a very rosy scenario when they're proposing their mines, saying, oh, there'll be no acid mine drainage, nothing's going to get out here, the impact from the dewatering is going to be minimal. And once it starts, things go wrong, or certainly many of my clients and folks in the West predicted that this would happen. Then you have these massive pollution problems, and the companies go bankrupt or leave. They're supposed to have bonds, they call them, or financial assurances in place to clean up that, but the bonds never cover, required by the state and federal agencies, never cover if something goes wrong. And once something goes seriously wrong, usually, the company goes bankrupt and hightails it out of there, and a lot of these companies are shell companies that don't have assets really to speak of except the minerals at the site. But when they go bad, it's a real problem. Speaking of Colorado, in the San Juan Mountains in the southwestern part of our state, one of the industry's most notorious mines was called the Summitville Mine, and that had cyanide leakage problems, acid mine drainage problems. The company, when the problems got pretty bad, just pulled up stakes and told the federal and state regulators, we're out of here. And this was back in the early 90s, and EPA had to come in on an emergency superfund authority and has been spending taxpayer dollars ever since then, $200-$300 million and counting, to try to at least not clean up forever to back to its original condition. That's impossible, but at least to get a handle and prevent the most serious water quality problems from Summitville and some other mines are similar stories. But Summitville is the notorious example here in Colorado. So obviously when one of these mines gets proposed in your favorite watershed or your aboriginal homelands and sacred areas or your favorite hunting or fishing spot or hiking spot, you're naturally concerned because some mines can, even if they don't violate federal environmental laws like Clean Water Act or something like that, they're still massively destructive, even if they don't have a per se pollution violation problem. So when one of these comes in, the environment in your region will never be the same. It's just a question of how bad it's going to get, depending on oftentimes the geology, the financial condition of the company, for example. But the BLM and the Forest Service has never said no to any of the mines out there, with just a few exceptions, and usually those are some of the smaller mines where the company didn't have their act together. But what we do here at the Western Mining Action Project is often litigate, suing the federal agencies or state agencies who are approving mines that probably shouldn't be going in because of the pollution threat or the destruction of very valuable public resources.
A couple things. One is, the main work I've actually done as activism historically has been more fighting timber sales than mines.
Mm-hmm.
And I just I want to say also that in the hundreds, if not thousands, of environmental impact statements and environmental assessments that I have attempted to fight, every time the federal government, the Forest Service, is required to present a no-action alternative, in which case they don't actually log, and in none of those EAs or EISs was the no-action alternative ever selected. It's just extraordinary to me. I'm just saying the same thing with logging that you just said with mining, that you know, they may be required by law to include the possibility that they won't do it, but that happens about as often as somebody gets hit by lightning twice.
Right. And actually, it's worse for mining, because in all the EISs for and environmental assessments for mining, they actually say, well, the law, the courts have said they have to look at the no-action alternative, the project denial alternative. But they actually say, due to that old 1872 mining law, they cannot choose it. By law, they cannot choose it. Where, let's say, if you or I, or I tell my students at the law school, if John Muir was running the Forest Service, he would have the discretion to deny timber sale proposals. He, if he was in charge of the BLM, he would deny oil and gas leasing requests from the industry, for example. Can't do that for mining. They don't have the discretion to say no. So it's these environmental reviews that the agencies do, they do them reluctantly because they know in the end they are going to approve the mine no matter what. Now, they'll say they will mitigate all potential environmental damage, et cetera, and we get in court battles over that, but they will say that they have no authority to say no. Now, we have some cases in court that are challenging that undenied right to mine, or undeniable right to mine, that the industry and, frankly, the Obama administration is taking the same position as the Bush administration, which is they won't say no to the mines, mine proposals. And that is obviously a concern for folks around the West.
So this whole thing, I mean, everything you're saying, if it didn't have consequences in the real world, would be like something you would see in a really bad comedic movie. I mean, this is, you know, environmental effects that last forever. They can't say no. A law that was passed 142 years ago, that somehow ends up. This is all like the makings of a really bad satire or something.
Well, you know, if the industry was on the phone here, a mining lawyer, a mining industry executive, they say, well, we have to comply with. We are the most scrutinized industry. We have to comply with the most federal and state environmental laws. Because there are state agencies in the West that regulate mining on public and private lands. A lot of lands, obviously, are not public lands. But one of the interesting things is they have to comply with all of these laws, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, et cetera, because they impact all of these resources that these laws are set up to protect, you know, water pollution, air pollution, things like that. But the problem is the agencies working with the mining companies, particularly the big ones, and their law firms and technical teams of experts, we'll say, well, we're not going to violate the Clean Water Act. We're not going to violate the Clean Air Act. We're going to do all these things. And that sometimes that may be true. Other times it's not. When the smoke clears, when the mine gets in and starts operating, we have violations start accruing very rapidly at some mines. But then it just ignores the fundamental issue on Western public lands is, for example, folks I work with in Crested Butte, Colorado, you're probably familiar, that mountain town, there's been a mine proposed there off and on since the 70s. And the Forest Service has continually said, we can't say no. unless we show that it's going to violate the Clean Water Act, for example, which you're really not going to know until the minority goes in. So it's a catch-22 for the public, and that's the real crux of the matter. If I could change one thing in federal mining law and policy, is to make mining at least equal with other resources. The Forest Service could say no to a ski resort, which they did near Crested Butte. The BLM could say no to an oil and gas lease. For example, they pulled back some leases near Arches and Canyonlands National Park in Utah a few years ago. But they don't do that for mining because they feel the 1872 mining law ties their hands, and oftentimes, even if they wanted to, they feel that they can't. And so that's the real difference for folks who don't live with these issues day to day, is that mining trumps the other valuable resources of our public lands, whether environmental protection, Native American cultural and religious issues, tourism and recreation. It's mining wins, and that's going back in the United States since the Civil War era, and you know, internationally for centuries before that. And then that's the problem. But to try to get that exalted position leveled out, which would take congressional action, it just hasn't happened due to the influence of the industry in today's House of Representatives, but historically also in the U.S. Senate due to the voting power of the Western senators.
I know that the big mines are the real problem. I want to ask about small sluice operations or whatever, primarily because there are some problems, especially a couple counties south of here, where people are dewatering, just individuals are dewatering salmon streams to run their small claims. And there's a real problem with, I don't know if we want to say that the BLM is not particularly interested in resolving it, or whether the BLM is, if we give them the benefit of the doubt, we say that they're understaffed and don't have the time to deal with it. But in any case, how big a problem? I know once again that the big mines are the big problem, but how big is a problem is also these small sort of semi-legal mines that might fall under. They do have claims that are legal, but then they're not really observed so much.
Right. It's really, depending on where you are, it is a very large problem. In your neck of the woods in Northern California, we had finally prevailed after 8 years of litigation against the Forest Service, who refused to comply with the Endangered Species Act. We represented the Karuk tribe of California fighting to protect salmon, and you know what salmon means to the Indian peoples of the Northwest, and both spiritually, culturally, economically, subsistence-wise, these hundreds of, one of the problems is what's known as suction dredge mining, where you have a small floating barge about, you know, an 8x12 rug or something like that with pontoons, and there's be a motor on it, and essentially they would go into the stream and suck up, vacuum up the river bottom, and would entrain, you know, suck it up onto this little centrifugal force, because the thing about gold is it's heavier than most minerals like rock and sand and stuff like that. And then they would spit out it would entrain the gold in these machines, these flakes, and then dump out all the silt and mud and rocks and stones back in the stream. Well, you can imagine what that does for aquatic life habitat, salmon habitat, and things like that. California, to its credit, the state of California has banned that practice. The mining industry has sued. It's currently under litigation. The miners are trying to get around the ban. A lot of the miners have moved north of the border into Oregon to do this. Oregon has not banned it. And so you have hundreds of miles, if not thousands of river and stream miles in the Northwest, where there's a big issue. We're dealing with similar practices in Idaho, where the suction dredge mining, the agencies view it as, each one is relatively small scale, so they feel that they don't really regulate these too much, but you add them up and the old proverb of death by a thousand strokes is what comes in here, and it really does a number on a watershed, if you could imagine what hundreds of these suction dredge will do in a river system.
So we have 6 or 7 minutes left, or 5 or 6 minutes, and I guess I have three questions. One is, you've said Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act. What are tools that people, including you, use to stop this? The second question is, what do you see as the the short to midterm future of any fight against the 1872 mining law? And then the third question is going to be, what can people, both who live in the West and who may be in an affected area, and then also people who may live in New York City who are not in an affected area, what would you like for them to either understand or do, having listened to this interview? So if you can answer any one, two, or three of those three questions, I'd be
Well, maybe I'll take the third one first. Determine public opposition. I think your readers, listeners, and you know what the value of citizen activism, citizen pressure can do. If you know of a mine coming in your area, search out local conservation groups, make alliances. For example, we have a big case in Arizona where it's a great united alliance of large ranching and farming operations, sportsmen's groups, citizens groups, Native American tribes, all working together. Even if there were some, you might disagree about other things about, large-scale agriculture or whatever. The mines are so destructive. United citizen opposition has really, at least it puts the companies and the agencies on notice that they're going to be watched. And when you tie that with fluctuating minerals prices, a lot of the boom and bust, as you can imagine, those tied to minerals prices. We were dealing with a real surge in uranium proposals just a few years ago. 10 years ago, I barely taught uranium mining issues in my classes at the law school. Now I spend a whole full day, an hour and a half on it, because there are hundreds of proposals. And now they're dying off because prices have the boom is busted, so we have a lot of companies pulling back. So determined citizen opposition, tied with the drop in metal prices, you can win your fights. There are many examples of people who win fights. And if that won't do it, if the company doesn't pull out, again, the agencies aren't going to say no. They don't view their job as saying no to these operations. They view their job as saying yes. Then you have, that's where, the Western Mining Action Project comes in. There's other great law firms, both public interest and as well as private attorneys that specialize in environmental law. And, in our adversarial system in the United States, it takes lawsuits sometimes to get the other side, whether the mining company or the federal or state agency, to comply with the law. So Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, law that you mentioned sort of before, the National Environmental Policy Act that requires environmental reviews, that doesn't have any teeth to actually stop mining, but it certainly shines a spotlight on the worst aspects of proposed operations and gives the public a right to participate. So if your listeners get an email or a spam or something from an environmental group talking about a mine coming in, don't throw it away. See if you can help out, even if it's just signing on to comments or submitting some comments and getting public pressure on these agencies to do the right thing and implement these laws. Because as you can imagine, we have many, many lawsuits over the last 20 plus years dealing with these federal and state environmental laws. They're on the books, and if they were implemented properly the way we think they should be and the public thinks they should be, many more mines would not go in because we feel that they violate numerous laws. Sometimes mines will violate numerous laws just in one proposal. So determine citizen pressure, and then, working with folks like us, experts, so to speak, on these legal issues to put pressure on and litigate if necessary. Again, it's tough because, the courts will naturally defer to these agencies, the so-called experts, so it's tough to win one of these cases. And then dealing with the 1872 mining law right now, as you can imagine, in Congress, we're playing defense, to be honest. The majority in the House and the industry supporters in the Senate actually are pushing agenda to weaken the 1872 mining law and any environmental reviews to speed up mine permitting, if you can imagine that. Big mines do take a number of years to permit just because the destruction is so great. The laws require the agencies to review these. But right now we're trying to block the weakening of the federal system, and right now it's the most pro-industry legal system you can have for an extractive industry, a mineral industry in the country. And so we're playing defense to try to hold on to the gains, at least in Congress. But we've had some success in some state legislatures. Colorado's just improved its uranium processing environmental requirements. The Colorado legislature, we've got through a number of bills over the last few years to strengthen that due to some pretty uranium mills of concern that have polluted water. So things have, there are some success stories often at the state level and the local level, but I would not hold your breath for positive reform in Congress, particularly these days with Congress so dysfunctional and the leadership certainly in the House in such a pro-development, pro-industry mode that you know, we're just playing defense right now.
Well, that, of course, makes work like yours and work by anybody doing opposing these minds all that much more important. So we're out of time, and I would like to thank you so much for your really important work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Roger Flynn. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.